Good morning. My name is Therese, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the AAAS conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you have already done so, please press the pound sign now. Then press star one again to ensure your question is registered. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. I will now turn the call over to Ms. Natasha Pinnell with AAAS. You may begin your conference.
Hello, and thank you for joining us today to discuss research that will appear in this Friday's issue of the journal Science. I'm Natasha Pinnell, Senior Communications Officer in the AAAS Office of Public Programs. This embargo telebriefing is being made possible through the generosity of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the nonprofit international society that publishes the Science family of journals. In cooperation with the Max Planck Institute, the University of California, Santa Cruz, and Harvard Medical School. A reminder that all information disclosed in this telebriefing will remain embargoed until 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time tomorrow, Thursday, 6 May, 2010. On the line with me are Dr. Laura Zahn, Associate Editor of Life Sciences at the journal Science, and our speakers, who will each give about three-minute summaries of their primary conclusions. We have Dr. Svante Paabo, a geneticist at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig, Germany, and senior author on the science papers. Dr. Ed Green, assistant professor of biomolecular engineering in the Baskin School of Engineering at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and the first author of the paper titled A Draft Sequence of the Neanderthal Genome. And Dr. David Reich, associate professor at the Harvard Medical School Department of Genetics and also a corresponding author on the Green et al. Paper. Dr. Zahn will first offer a few comments about science's perspective in publishing this research, then the authors will participate in the question and answer session following their remarks. Thanks again for joining us. Laura?
Asha? Neanderthals are the closest ancestors to modern-day humans, but relatively little is known about how they might have impacted our own evolutionary trajectory. Green et al. Have sequenced over 3 billion base pairs from three Neanderthal individuals representing approximately 60% of their genome, as well as five modern humans from diverse populations spanning the globe. From analyses of these data, they offer new insights, including suggestions that interspecies breeding may have occurred, resulting in the humans of non-African descent containing 1 to 4% Neanderthal DNA. Using this information, they also examined genetic differences between humans and Neanderthals, which offer a host of candidate genes that diverge between the species to examine further for functional changes. This immense data set is sure to be a valuable resource for geneticists and anthropologists who I anticipate will pore over it for years to determine which of these genetic sequences explain the evolutionary success of our own species. Beyond this paper, we see documentation of the advances made over the past few years in sequencing technology and our understanding of those complications that may arise when dealing with ancient DNA. In combination with the Green et al. Manuscript, recent technological advances are also showcased by Burbano et al., which describes a target sequence capture approach that enabled researchers to obtain and sequence numerous genomic sequences simultaneously from ancient DNA samples that are heavily degraded and/or contaminated by microbial DNA. This leverages our ability to reveal the secrets of the past. These studies will help inform us both on our own origins while at the same time more fully illuminating what it is that makes us human.
Okay, Dr. Paabo?
Okay, thank you. So, well, let me then first perhaps say that it's extremely satisfying, of course, that we now have a first overview over the Neanderthal genome after 4 years of intense efforts in this project. And as Laura pointed out, this is so exciting because the Neanderthals are our closest evolutionary relatives. If we want to define genetically what makes all humans that live today unique, not only relative to our closest living relatives, the chimpanzees, but to our closest extinct relatives, the Neanderthals, we can now begin to do so. So what I want to do is, a little bit, give you some technical aspects and background of the project, and then Ed Green and David Reich will talk on some of the most interesting analysis of the data that we have done. So our interest then in Neanderthal DNA really goes back to the mid-90s when we presented the very first Neanderthal DNA sequences from the mitochondrial genome. And they then showed that the mitochondrial genome of the Neanderthal falls outside the variation of present-day humans and that there had been no contribution from Neanderthals of mitochondrial DNA to us. Of course, that was very limited because the mitochondrial genome is just a tiny part of our genome, it's maternally inherited, and so on. But I really thought until 6-7 years ago that it would remain impossible for at least my lifetime to sequence the entire nuclear genome of Neanderthals. And that then changed with technological developments, with high-throughput sequencing technologies that came around 6-7 years ago. And in 2006, we and others showed that one could apply this to ancient DNA, and we then launched a more large-scale project to apply this to the Neanderthal genome. And there are four areas, I would say, with difficulties you then have to deal with. The first is that in those bones that are 30, 40,000 years old, there's of course very little DNA preserved, very little Neanderthal DNA, and quite a lot of bacterial and fungal DNA. So 96% or 97% or more is from bacteria and fungi and not from the Neanderthals themselves. The DNA fragments we obtain are very short, 40, 50 base pairs, and they also contain chemical modifications which might give incorrect DNA sequences. And the last sort of area of problems is then contamination from present-day human DNA, which might be mistaken for Neanderthal DNA and affect your results. So what we've done over the past few years is look at very many Neanderthal bones to identify those that have particularly much Neanderthal DNA in them. That turns out to be 2, 3, 4% of the DNA from the Neanderthal. We have optimized very judiciously all the steps in how we come from the DNA in the bone to something we can put in a sequencing machine. So we're now in the order of 500-fold more efficient in that process than we were when this project started. So when we have now sequenced 3 billion base pairs from these three Neanderthal bones, we've used only in the order of 500 milligrams, so half a gram of bones to do that. We've also developed computer programs, and Ed Green has been particularly involved in that, that match these short fragments to the human and chimp genomes, taking into account both that they are short and have these chemical modifications. And we've developed methods to deal with modern human contamination, for example, adding short synthetic little pieces of DNA to the ends of each molecule in our clean room before they come out. So what we have then produced is these 3 billion base pairs of the Neanderthal genome, and it's primarily a tool, of course, for all future biologists to address questions of what makes humans unique relative to Neanderthals and all other organisms. What we then present in the paper are three groups of analysis that we have performed with the data. And the first is just the beginning of a catalog that will eventually, when we produce a much better genome, more complete genome in the next few years, become more comprehensive. But we will look at all features in the genome where humans differ from the Neanderthals and the Neanderthals look like the apes. And these features, the fascinating thing is that they turn out to not be that many. So when we, for example, look at amino acid changes in proteins, we find only 78 such amino acid changes where all humans look similar today and the Neanderthals fall outside. So they will all be interesting to study in the future. Then we look for positive selection, and Ed Green will talk more in detail about that, where we look for areas in the genome where the Neanderthal fall outside the variation of modern humans because something special happened in humans in this area of the genome, and we find interesting candidate genes there. And finally, we look at the relationship of Neanderthals to present-day people around the world today. And David Reich will talk in detail about that. And what we find is that the Neanderthals are slightly more similar in their genome to people outside Africa, no matter if they live in Europe, Asia, or Papua New Guinea. So it suggests that there has been gene flow from Neanderthals, or shows actually there has been gene flow to Neanderthals, presumably into an ancestral population of modern humans that became the ancestors of all these present-day humans. So this is what is in this paper, and it's of course just, if you want, a beginning of exploration of human uniqueness that is now possible.
Thank you, Dr. Pabo. Dr. Green?
Okay, great. That was a really comprehensive overview of the project. I'm Ed Green at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and for the last 4 years, I have been a postdoc with Svante in Leipzig at the Max Planck Institute there, and my primary job there was the sequencing and analysis of the Neanderthal genome. As Svante said, the project got started 5 or 6 years ago at the beginning of this wave of high-throughput sequencing, the revolution that was really going on there, and most of my efforts were aimed at applying these great new tools to ancient DNA. While I was there, I worked with a really talented group of molecular biologists and helped shepherd the data through the great improvements that they were making in getting DNA out of bones and getting it into libraries for sequencing. And doing this, we got to see for the first time a real global perspective of what ancient DNA looked like, what types of chemical damage were there, and where the chemical damages occurred in the molecules. And working with some great programmers there, specifically Udo Stenzel, we applied this knowledge and wrote a lot of custom software to sensitively and accurately identify and align the Neanderthal DNA sequences that we're getting to the human and chimpanzee genomes so that we could do downstream analyses that were not biased by weirdnesses that occur in ancient DNA. As Svante mentioned, on the analysis side, we implemented this idea that was born in Svante's mind a long time ago for using the Neanderthal sequence to identify regions of the human genome where variation is not shared with Neanderthals. Ordinarily, the variation that separates two humans is often old enough such that it can be shared with Neanderthals. It was born long enough ago in the past that some of it is inherited to Neanderthals. But one can now, with Neanderthal genome sequence, scan the human genome for regions where this is not the case. And one possibility for why this may not be the case is if there was some beneficial mutation that arose and swept through our ancestors, then we can see this now as regions that where variation is not shared with Neanderthals. And it turns out that this is a very powerful method for shining light on a region of time in our evolutionary history, not the evolutionary history of Neanderthals per se, but our evolutionary history and finding these important changes that happen in a really crucial time in human evolutionary history. So as described in the paper, we've identified some really interesting candidate regions and are currently looking to explore these further to understand exactly what changed and why. And that's it.
Thank you, Dr. Green. Dr. Reich?
So my name is David Reich. I'm at the Harvard Medical School Department of Genetics. I've been involved in this project for, I think, about 3 years, as collaborating. I'm a population geneticist, which means that I'm an expert in studying the relationships among human populations and learning about those from genetic data and genomic data. And I was brought on to the project and collaborated on the project to try to use this remarkable resource that the Max Planck Institute and Svante's group generated to try to learn about the relationships between Neanderthals and modern humans. So the main question that we set out to try to address with the Neanderthal genome, this amazing new resource, is how Neanderthals and modern humans are related, and in particular to address the issue that's been raised by the archaeological and fossil records, which is the evidence that Neanderthals and modern humans overlapped geographically in Europe and Western Asia between about 30,000 to 80,000 years ago. And this has prompted a debate that's gone on for a long time about whether there was interbreeding between them during this period. So the Neanderthal genome provides a unique tool for testing for gene flow, and we're able to largely resolve the controversy about whether there was gene flow occurred, and we think that there's very strong evidence that it did occur. Main finding is that there was gene flow from Neanderthals into the ancestors of all modern non-Africans, as Svante mentioned, and we do not find any evidence at all of gene flow into African, sub-Saharan Africans, including Nigerians and Southern African San Bushmen. We also don't find any evidence for gene flow in the reverse direction into Neanderthals. One thing that's very interesting is that it's not as if there are places in the genome that we found where all non-Africans have Neanderthal ancestry and all Africans do not have Neanderthal ancestry. In fact, each non-African today seems to have their Neanderthal ancestry in a different place in the genome. Another thing that's very interesting is what it says about the results interact with the archaeological record. While the extensively documented archaeological overlap of Neanderthals and modern humans in Europe has suggested to many that if gene flow did occur, the most likely location for that was in Europe itself, we find no evidence for gene flow specifically in Europe. The most powerful analyses we did involved comparing pairs of modern humans of diverse ancestry, and the signal we find is shared equally between Europeans and Eastern Asians and Papua New Guineans. That means that the gene flow signal that we are detecting occurred prior to the divergence of those populations from each other. The most simple explanation for where that might have occurred is somewhere in the Middle East or Northern Africa, at the gateway of Africa, as modern humans were migrating out for the first time, beginning about 45 to 60 or 80,000 years ago. Another thing that we're able to show using these analyses is that the proportion of Neanderthal inherited genetic material in non-Africans today, East Asians, Papua New Guineans, and Europeans, is about 1 to 4%. So it's a small but very real proportion of ancestry in non-Africans today. So I think that's where I'll stop.
Okay, well, thank you. Now we'll open the call for a question and answer session with the authors. Operator?
Thank you. At this time, I would like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. Please refrain from using the pound sign, as this will remove your request from the queue. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. One moment. And hold one moment, we're still compiling. Your first question comes from Rex Dalton with Nature.
Hello, Svante and Ed and everyone, thank you very much. A question regarding the coverage and the reads of the entire 60% of the genome that you have. Could you speak a little to the limitation? It's a 1.3 average coverage. Obviously, there's degradation and other issues. Can you speak a little bit to why you weren't able to get a broader, or more reads, more coverage, more repeats of that sequence at this stage?
Well, maybe a few words, and then maybe Ed can say more. I mean, so we have 1.3x coverage of the whole genome, which is the goal we set for this project 4 years ago. And what you would then expect is that you see this two-thirds about of the genome. What's the actual coverage in that two-thirds? Probably perhaps Ed will be able to answer that. I don't know, you want to say anything more, Ed?
Sure. So the 60%, it is not to be thought of necessarily as one one full coverage of the genome is like a walk that's 10 miles, and we've walked 6 miles and then stopped. This is really just a result of random sampling that we get on average one shot at every sequence, but of course, because random sampling, a lot of them we will just sample two times, sometimes even three times, and then others we won't sample at all. As more and more sequencing is done, as that's done in the future, then the bases that happen to be missed at this coverage will be covered more in the future. So largely, this is just the result of the random sampling issue that one has in shotgun sequencing. This is a little bit more complicated in the case of ancient DNA in that there are subtle preservation biases that are present. One is that for whatever reason, we see sequences that are GC-rich more often than sequences that are GC-poor. So we have slightly higher coverage in regions of the genome that are GC-rich than we do in regions that are GC-poor. On top of this, there's another wrinkle, and that is, as described in the paper, there is an enrichment strategy that we use that is a pretty clever thing that early on we were looking at sequence motifs that were overrepresented in this huge background of microbial sequences that were generating along with the small percent of Neanderthal sequences that we generate. And we look for sequence motifs, short little words in sequences that were commonly occurring in the microbial things that we didn't want and rarely occurring in the Neanderthal things that we do want. And it turns out that there are a lot of these, and usually they have the dinucleotide CG. And we then implemented this strategy where we would digest the libraries with the restriction enzyme, which is an enzyme that will cut DNA if it contains a specific sequence. And we use restriction enzymes that had these sequences that were overrepresented in the microbial DNA and underrepresented in the Neanderthal DNA. This is a great leap forward then in sequencing efficiency because you cut up a lot of the things you don't care to sequence and leave intact largely the things that you do care to sequence. But there is you don't entirely leave that intact. These words do occur at some low rate in the Neanderthal genome, and of course those regions of the genome we have zero or no coverage. So we don't get exactly the random sampling that one would get if we had not done this, but it's largely an issue of just random sampling. At this level of coverage yields about 60% of the genome covered at least once.
Thank you.
Operator, we'll take the next question, please.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Clive Cookson with Financial Times.
Thanks very much. I'm wondering whether, given the similarity, apparently, of Neanderthals to ourselves, whether it's still correct to call them a separate species, and if they were separate species, how easy it would have been for them to have interbred with us.
So this is Svante Paabo then. We have always been very cautious. We have never sort of taken a stand on our papers on how we define a species with respect to the Neanderthals and modern humans. I think that even with species or groups that live today in animal groups, we cannot always define fully what is a species. So I think we now describe here that there was interbreeding at some little level, and I would prefer to leave it up to others who want to quarrel about if one calls it two different species or not. There are several examples in nature of mice, for example, closely related, what is defined as species that have this level of interbreeding when they meet, but it depends really on what sort of definition you want to use for a species. And I think that's a rather fruitless discussion, actually. We have shown that it was biologically possible for them to interbreed, so that says something biologically, and that's interesting. If we want to call it two species or not, I'm not that interested in that, actually.
I know, but lay people and journalists have to use a word. Are you happy for us to call them still a species? Or what's a better word?
I would actually call them Neanderthals and humans, and I would more see them as a form of humans that were a bit more different than people are from each other today, but not that much. We also show here that for much of their genome, they do fall into our variation, right? So they were not genetically very distinct from us.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, operator. We'll take the next question, please.
Thank you. Your next question comes from David Perlman with the San Francisco Chronicle.
Thank you. I have just a quick question, I think. Svante Paabo, 4 years ago when you and Eddie Rubin published separate papers on the beginnings of all this, you indicated that in the interbreeding there was gene flow, appeared to be gene flow from male to female. Do you have any evidence, to strengthen that or change that, or can you determine from what kind of gene flow there was?
Yes, so maybe David is the best person to indicate that. I would say we have not able to say if it's particularly male or female gene flow. Is that right, David Reich?
Yes, that's right, Svante. I think that we've tried to look for evidence whether the gene flow, that signal that we detect, is more from males to females or females to males. And the way we tried to do that was to look at the X chromosome, which, of course, is inherited more in females than in males. Two-thirds of the X chromosomes in the world today are living in females. And so it would reflect more the history of females. And so if you see a systematic difference in the gene flow signal on the X chromosome and the rest of the genome, that would be evidence of one sex participating more in the gene flow than in the other. When we look at the X chromosome, unfortunately, we don't have very much data, and the signal of gene flow falls within the range of statistical error of the signal in the rest of the genome. So one thing that we might be able to do when we analyze the Neanderthal genome at higher resolution, once we have more Neanderthal sequence, when the finished genome becomes available in a few years, is we might be able to compare the X chromosome and the rest of the genome at higher resolution and test for sex biases.
Okay.
Perhaps I can just fill in that it was also, of course, the original mitochondrial genome showed no evidence of gene flow. So it was very tempting to suggest that if there was gene flow, it was males that was driving it. But mitochondrial DNA is just one little tiny part of the genome, and we have a much more comprehensive picture now and see that it has indeed occurred.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Nicholas Wade with New York Times.
Before your paper, we assumed that all human populations came from the same ancestral human population prior to the diaspora from Africa, and therefore that everyone was very similar. But the results of your paper surely show that Europeans and Asians are more different from Africans than we assumed hitherto, because of the up to 4% component of Neanderthal DNA. Is that correct?
Yes. So what we falsify here is this very hard out of Africa hypothesis, where all modern humans would come from a small population in Africa, replace everyone else in the world without any admixture. So what we show is outside Africa, there is this 1 to 4% that comes from archaic humans, Neanderthals. Of course, it's totally possible that also inside Africa, other archaic forms, which we don't know, contributed to Africans today. So I don't think one should take this as evidence of saying necessarily only people outside Africa have some caveman biology in them. I think that people in Africa may also have absorbed some archaic forms. We just don't know that presently.
But still, the populations are now more different than we thought, since now there is a new element in the Eurasian populations that we had not previously suspected.
Yes, there is this element, as David Reich also pointed out. all indications we have is that these are sort of random parts of the genome where some of you have some parts, I have some other parts that have happened to come from Neanderthals. There is at present no indication that there is something from the Neanderthals fixed in everyone outside Africa, for example. But it's certainly an indication of what went on socially when Neanderthals and modern humans met.
Okay. It looks like we'll take another question. Operator?
Thank you. Your next question comes from Ramos Jacobson with BifeCav.ek.
Right. Hello. And thank you very much. Well, I would really like to know about the coverage of these particular areas that you are focusing on in the paper, where you have, for example, five genes that you say have changed more than just one base. And so it seems to me to be important to know what is the coverage of those particular areas in order to say what you're saying. And I would also like to know what coverage do you reckon is needed to be able to say this is definitely a different base than that we have in human beings.
Yes, so at this coverage, what we do, if you read the paper carefully, is that we do not believe anything that is Neanderthal specific, because we sort of hold the door open to that may all be errors. We focus exclusively on things where humans today differ from chimpanzees and say, what is a Neanderthal at those positions? Is it like the apes or like the humans? And in that category of things, where we, so to say, helped by the human or chimpanzee and ape genomes, we have a very low error rate, because there are certain two particular states to ask if it's this or is it the other one. So that is, perhaps, I don't know if Ed wants to fill in something I overlooked.
No, I think that covers most of it. The specific answer to the question, the catalog of changes, it was enough if we see a single read that covers one of these, and as Svante said, either contains the chimpanzee, the ancestral base, or the new derived human base, if Neanderthal matched one or the other of those. If you read the paper carefully, we also, it's described there, sequence very deeply the libraries that are generated. Because this is such a precious resource, we want to really get all of the data that we can out of the DNA that we can get from these bones, and wind up sequencing each of these molecules many times on average. And this helps a bit with the with dealing with errors, because once we get a DNA sequence out of the bone and into a library, we usually get many chances to see what that sequence is. So the machine error then for the Neanderthal sequence actually gets to be quite low. We're left then just with the problems with ancient DNA, which are considerable, most of this residual error is dealt with by only considering positions where the human and the chimp are different and Neanderthal matches one of those.
Okay, well, I'm not quite sure I understand, but let me focus on, for example, this. You find this SPAG17 gene with semen flagellum, and you say that gene has some differences in it. So could you inform me how much is the coverage of that particular area?
Well, I would have to look this up to say for sure, but it was enough for to go in this catalog to just have one full coverage, so that very well could be a single Neanderthal observation that in this case matched the chimpanzee sequence. So the Neanderthal looks like the chimpanzee, and humans then are different at two positions in this gene.
Okay. And an additional question is, what's the cost of all this so far, and what's the coverage that you eventually aim to get? Is that 10-time coverage, or what coverage do you aim to get?
So our goal for the next 2-3 years is to come to somewhere between 10 and 20-fold coverage of the parts of the genome that are single copy, because having these short reads, that's the only parts we can really look at. So repetitive DNA, we will not be able to study very carefully. So 10 to 20x. The costs so far were in the order, it depends a bit how you calculate costs now. The sort of, one could say that this is in the order of 2 or 3 million euros that this project had cost. But it will be a lot cheaper to now go on, as always, once the technology is developed and we know how to do it, we can move forward much quicker and much more cost efficiently.
Thank you.
Thank you. Your next question comes from David Brown with Washington Post.
Yes, thank you very much. Getting back to these five genes where you found a complete divergence between the Neanderthals and human beings, it's really interesting, and it, one can sort of imagine a narrative here. We have, sperm function, wound healing, and, the skin stuff, so that, mating, fighting, and running away or something. And I'm wondering if you could sort of talk a little bit about why those might have been, such an active area for natural selection, and in particular the stuff with skin and epidermal and hair follicles and everything, which more modern studies have shown is a highly derived feature that differs between ethnic groups in the world today.
So yes, I would like, other guys can fill in later, but I would like to somehow stay as cautious as we are in the paper. That list, these genes, these five genes, are of course not completely divergent. These are just genes that have two amino acid changes in them, or a change in the start and stop codon positions. So they are still quite similar, but they are the extreme outliers in terms of this little difference we do see from the Neanderthals. And it's quite striking, I think, as you say, that three of these genes are expressed in the skin. This may mean that, or it really suggests that something in the physiology or the morphology of the skin has changed in humans, probably compared to Neanderthals, or perhaps even earlier in our evolution. Once we have a high coverage Neanderthal genome, we might see that these genes differ, changed there too quite a bit. It could be that in the common ancestor of Neanderthals and humans, skin changed, and these genes are now allowed to change quite a lot. Because what we do not see in the skin expressed genes is that they fall in the regions where we find positive selection in this other analysis that Ed Green described earlier. So I would say it's tantalizing that these things in skin, for example, changed, but the biological interpretation of that is not at all clear yet at the moment. If it's positive selection for something new in humans, or is that these genes lost function because the skin physiology changed in our lineage or even in the common ancestor of Neanderthals and modern humans. I'm sorry not to be able to give more specific speculation.
Does Dr. Green want to comment about that? Or?
I would just add, in the spirit of being very cautious at this point, that I think these results are interesting in that they really point out what we can do with the Neanderthal sequence now. But a complete understanding of this is really a stepwise process. And what we have done here is take a really important step forward. We can say now exactly which changes happened where we have coverage anyway, very recently, even since we diverged from Neanderthals. And with this really high resolution, say this particular amino acid in this protein was very recently the ancestral form, but has come to fixation in humans now, as far as we can tell. And then the next step would be real molecular characterization of this to ask what was the change associated with this amino acid difference. That part is to be done for the future, but what we can do now is really go in and say exactly where it is, and it leads nicely to the next experiment, but that next experiment has not been done yet.
Okay, and can I just confirm that the skin genes, you say that there is not evidence of positive selection, there's just this difference, this clear difference between Neanderthal and modern human, but we can't deduce that it's because the human ones are a derived allele that has some evolutionary advantage?
No, we cannot infer that from the data we have. But they are very interesting because they reached high frequency in humans in a short time, which would be one characteristic of something that could be positively selected. But they're not overlapping with these regions we find of particularly strong evidence for positive selection that involve these other genes in the later part of the paper.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Dan Bergano with USA Today.
Thanks very much. I just had a couple questions. I was wondering if you could put the 1 to 4% interbreeding into context. The paper says that this might have come from relatively few interbreeding events. Does that take that to mean that not 1 to 4% of all matings between the human species at that time were with Neanderthals? How would you explain that to our readers? And I have a follow-up.
Maybe David Reich want to talk about that.
Sure. So the 1 to 4% is an aggregate number, the total proportion of the ancestry of non-Africans today that we think traces its lineages through to the Neanderthal side rather than to the modern human side, since the two groups originally diverged. Now, that could have occurred in quite a number of different ways. It could have occurred in the context of a very large number of matings among large populations, or a small number of matings, even dozens or small number, into a quite small founding population of modern humans moving outside of Africa and encountering Neanderthals. So we really can't tell, at least from the analysis that we've done so far, maybe further analyses might be able to reveal something about this, whether there were a small number of actual gene exchanges into a small population or a large number of gene exchanges into a large population. Both could have the same proportionate effect on the ancestral population of non-Africans today. One thing that we tried to explain in our paper is that the detection of a signal of gene flow in the ancestors of non-Africans from Neanderthals, but the failure to detect it specifically into the European population, where we know that Neanderthals and modern humans also overlapped, and also failure to detect other direction of gene flow into Neanderthals, doesn't mean it didn't occur. It just means that we don't have statistical power to detect it. So there's actually a well-known phenomenon that when range expansions occur, not just in humans but in other species, that when a small colonizing population, say the ancestors of modern humans moving into the Middle East as a hypothetical, move into the territory of a already established and large population, that there's often much more signature of gene flow into the small expanding population, which will then expand to a large size, than in the reverse direction. And a simple way to think about this is that even if there's gene flow in both directions, 10 gene exchanges into a population of 100 makes a very large proportional effect on the ancestry of that population. But 10 gene exchanges into a large population of 10,000 is a drop in the bucket and is hard to detect. And so it may just be that what we're seeing is an expected effect as the ancestors of modern humans moved into a region where there were already Neanderthals and there was some amount of gene exchange. And since this was a wave front of an expansion moving into a new territory, those gene exchanges, even if there were relatively few of them, got amplified further. In the same way, in Europe itself, why don't we see evidence of gene flow, even though it's well documented based on the archaeological records that for 10,000 years Neanderthals and modern humans lived side by side and must have encountered each other? Maybe they did exchange genes sometimes, and we know they must have been able to based on the findings in this paper biologically. Maybe they did exchange genes, but the gene exchange was between two already large and well-established populations, and so we just don't have power to detect it. So it's important to recognize that the failure to detect a signal of gene flow doesn't mean that it didn't occur, but the detection of gene flow means that it did occur, and so that we have this one signal that we detect, which is ancestral to all non-African populations today.
Very good. The follow-up question is, I wonder if you could more directly talk about the question that was raised earlier about differences between Eurasian and African populations. As you know from the bell curve controversy, that sort of thing, there are a lot of people in our society who like to see differences between the races, but you're seeing genes that are distributed randomly, don't seem to be selected for positive selection. You know, is someone who sees your results and proclaims great differences between the races based on them making a mistake in your view? How would you address that?
I think maybe I should let Svante respond to that, and I could follow up with any further questions.
Well, I think the issue is, if you want to somehow present genetic data in a sort of racist perspective, you can always find your arguments. One way to talk about this would be to say, well, obviously people outside Africa are more primitive, are more caveman-like, because they have this part of their ancestry from Neanderthals, which generally has a bad rap in people's heads, right? Obviously, if you're biased in the other direction, you could say this obviously means it's something good to have Neanderthal ancestry. And as I said, neither is probably true. It is just that you have random parts of the genome that have come from Neanderthals into non-Africans. I would hold it very likely, actually, that there were other archaic forms in Africa which modern humans encountered there and may have obtained gene flow from, only we don't have the fossils and don't have the genomes of those archaic forms to study. So I would really think that there's no basis whatsoever to link this to any sort of advantage of one group over another.
Just following that up a little bit, I completely agree with what Svante said, and just to try to answer some of your technical questions, we really do not find, first of all, any evidence of a particular genetic variant that seems to have come from Neanderthals that all modern non-Africans have that's not present in Africans, that's swept through the population. And that might be interesting if it occurred, but we've actually looked, and the variants we find are in general quite rare. 1-4% on average, and we find rarely above 10% when we've looked. And in addition, these analyses of gene flow, when we break the analyses of gene flow up into regions near genes and regions far away from genes, which were presumably more or less affected by natural selection for traits, we see exactly the same signal. So it's not as if the bits of genetic ancestry that are coming in through gene flow are concentrated to a very unusual extent in genes.
Not to any particular region of the genome or genic regions? Or
we haven't found any evidence of that, and we've done some looking already.
Have you seen anything about the length of the repeat in the D4 dopamine receptor? That's a question a few people have asked me. Might be too technical for an email later, but that's fine.
Yes, we should probably answer that via email.
Thanks very much, guys. Appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Operator, we'll take another question, please.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Karen Bojo with Dagens Nyheter.
Hello, thank you. I'm Karin Boys from Dagens Nyheter in Stockholm. And you have already touched this subject, but anyway, I would like to ask Svante Paabo how your findings corresponds to earlier claims by Bruce Liu that there are a couple of Neanderthal genes in the Eurasian population that made them smarter, that there had been a positive selection.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so Bruce Lawn has published for this microcephalin gene, for example, that there is a variant outside Africa that is quite high in frequency, and it's suggested that it came from Neanderthals. Our analysis doesn't support that, in that the Neanderthals we have looked at does not carry that variant, the so-called D haplotype that's frequent outside Africa. So it's not supported here. Of course, we only looked at 3 Neanderthals. It could be that it was in some other Neanderthal and did come from the Neanderthals, but we find no evidence of it. Yes, that would be my answer to that. I don't know if David has anything more to say about.
Yeah, I did want to sort of, I think that that's absolutely right. There's no validation that the the microcephalin D haplotype is a Neanderthal-derived haplotype, and so that it may be the case if we looked at additional Neanderthals, but it greatly weakens the evidence for that. I did want to comment that one of our important lines of evidence for gene flow is kind of related to that kind of test, even though the example of the Bruce Lahn paper doesn't seem to be validated in our data. There's been a really interesting literature which people like Michael Hammer and Dan Garrigan and Jeff Wall have been involved in, where they've been looking for genetic variants that are strands of human genetic variation that are very distinct from those in other modern humans. That is, you look in modern human populations today and you look for a particular stretch of DNA that looks quite different from what you see in other modern humans, maybe a million or 2 million years separated, and is only present in non-Africans. And this is a very interesting and strange pattern that's not really hard to rarely expected in the absence of gene flow, because we know that, of course, Africans have more diversity, and so seeing that the case where the highest diversity is outside of Africa and there's very deep lineages suggests that these might be inherited from an ancestral population. So Rasmus Nielsen, one of the collaborators on our consortium, did an analysis where he and his colleagues looked through the genome, not using Neanderthal ancestry DNA at all, to identify segments of the genome that had this characteristic of only being quite anciently diverged from other modern humans and only present in non-Africans. And then we lifted the veil on the Neanderthal sequence and compared them to these segments. And what we found is really quite remarkable. Of the 12 regions in the genome where the signal was strongest, 10 of them, Neanderthal matched the relatively rare variant that was deeply diverged and only seen in non-Africans. And this is one of the important late pieces of evidence for gene flow. Without gene flow, we would expect that number to be very small, a very small rate of matching of those 12. But instead, we see 10 out of 12.
Thank you. Operator, we'll take another question, please.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Hertan Escobar with Estado Newspaper.
Hi. I'd like to go back to the 1-4% and just wonder if you guys can qualify it in any way. Like, what's in this 1-4%? Is it just random nucleotides on the genome, or is there any evidence that we might have inherited traits or characteristics from Neanderthals?
Yes. So this is really what David Reich answered earlier, and I would just reiterate that as far as we can tell presently, it's just random pieces of DNA. There is no evidence that there is more contribution or higher frequency contribution, for example, close to genes than in regions where there are not genes. So I would say there is no evidence for that this has any particular functional consequences of something that would be unified outside Africa.
Okay, thank you. And if I may add just another quick one, the 40% that has, if I'm saying, has not been sequenced yet, mm-hmm. could that change significantly the results of the interpretation of the data?
I would not say so. 60% is still a very good statistical sample of the entire genome. So from the things we present in the paper, we are convinced that it will not change the picture dramatically. It might be that when we have the whole single copy part of the genome, we will be able to detect smaller signals of other events that might have happened, maybe gene flow in the other direction also. But what now stands will remain. I hope, I'm convinced and hope that that's the case.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Paul Rincon with BBC News.
Hello there. I just wanted to ask a quick question. It may have been answered by the what you said recently about those old sequences that matched the Neanderthals 10 out of 12. But I wanted to know whether you thought that this finding might be the tip of the iceberg, and perhaps modern humans may have mated with many other different types of archaic humans as they moved out of Africa. For example, the Denisova hominin or Homo erectus in Southeast Asia.
Yes, I don't know if the others want to fill in, but I would say once we have now seen that this happened with Neanderthals, and I was quite surprised to find that. I was probably biased really in the direction of thinking it would not have happened.
once we've now seen it, I wouldn't sort of put it beyond myself and archaic humans that it would have happened elsewhere also. So it's certainly something we will look at when we study the Denisova hominin, and as I said, I think there will be other archaic forms that we don't have remains of, even in Africa, for example, that might have contributed.
I was wondering what the do you have any evidence yet for any or any signs of any mixing within Africa from the looking at present day genomes?
I mean, others have studied variation in Africa and found evidence of sort of deep structure in Africa that could be due to this. So I think the door is open for that something like that could have happened in Africa. I don't know if David wants to comment something specific on that, but
I think that's absolutely right. And Africa is, of course, the cradle of modern humans, and there's settlements across a very wide geographic range, and would not be a surprise if there was deep structure in Africa. And analysis of genetic variation has found evidence of distinct separated lineages in some African populations that people have interpreted as possible evidence for ancient structure, and that's very interesting evidence. Unfortunately, we don't have genomes from archaic Africans. DNA doesn't preserve as well from Africa in general. It's warmer but maybe eventually we will, and that might shed light on those questions.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Karen Kaplan with the Los Angeles Times.
Hi, thanks very much. As you just mentioned, Dr. Pablo, that you were kind of surprised to find this result that the extent of gene flow into non-Africans was the same whether it was the French guy or the fellow from Papua New Guinea. And I was just wondering what you guys did when you got that result. Did you believe it right away, or did you, subject it to further tests you hadn't originally planned just to confirm that?
Well, I can just perhaps first talk for myself. I think first I thought it was some statistical fluke. I thought it was some bias in our data or how we analyze it. And then we discussed very much with David Reich and with Monte Slatkin and Rasmus Nielsen and population geneticists. And they came up with these clever other three different approaches that we present in the paper. With three different totally independent analyses that all come to the conclusion that this has happened. And that is really what convinced me. That's, for example, Rasmus Nielsen's approach, where you look totally at non-African evidence relative to Africa without looking at the Neanderthals, find these deep lineages, and then find them in the Neanderthal afterwards. Or this second line of analysis we present in the paper, where segments of the Neanderthal genome that is particularly close to one human, the human reference genome, tend to be particularly distant from other present-day humans, such as Craig Venter, suggesting that it comes in from some other group, such as Neanderthals. And original evidence, of course, that when we compare sites where people in Africa and non-Africans differ, the Neanderthal tends to be a bit more often similar to non-Africans. So it's really this three independent line of evidence that convinced me that this is not some artifact of some sort.
I'd like to comment a little bit further. I think that we really, as a consortium, came into this with a very, very strong bias against gene flow, and I think that that's very good for the conclusion that we came up to in the end. I think that given that we are coming to this conclusion, having started out with such a strong bias against it, means that the case, I think, is likely to be stronger than if we had instead been people who believed there was gene flow in the first place. And then just looked for perhaps some evidence of it. When we got this initial signal of gene flow, which was more than a year ago or a year and a half ago even, Svante and in general many others in Leipzig, Ed and others, were very, very skeptical, and the whole group, including ourselves, looked for alternative explanations. We looked for the possibility that perhaps contamination of modern human sequence that was non-African could explain that data, but we ruled that out in many, many different ways. It just can't do it. And in fact, that would look like gene flow from from the, modern humans into Neanderthals, of course, rather than the reverse direction. And that's not what we see. We looked for evidence that biases in the sequencing due to the complex nature of Neanderthal sequence might be explaining the phenomenon. But we ruled that out as well. And then we came up with these additional lines of evidence that were not based on the initial observation and really completely independent from them. And those things together make us feel that it's a convincing case for gene flow. The bias in the genetics community for the last 20 years has been increasing evidence in general that modern non-Africans are descended from a single migration out of Africa. And while we haven't ruled out mixture completely, the proportion of mixture that's been ruled out has been higher and higher and higher over time. We haven't ruled out this 1 to 4% that we now detect. But in general, the history of our field as geneticists had been not finding evidence for gene flow and that the out-of-Africa migration was a very strong pattern. And so this was, I think, really a surprise to us and something we worked very hard to put on strong footing.
Well, now that you guys have this evidence, it seems kind of obvious in retrospect that if we knew there were Neanderthals in the Middle East, and there seems to be archaeological evidence of that, and we know that the modern humans would have had to pass through there on the way out of Africa, do you look back now and wonder why did we think there was only interbreeding in Europe if it happened at all?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's in hindsight, everything always seems obvious, right? There has, of course, been a group of paleontologists, the sort of multi-regionalist school in anthropology, in paleontology, that have seen intermediate forms, but generally stressing regional continuity, saying that early modern humans in Europe tend to look a little related to Neanderthals. Early modern humans in Asia tend to look related to earlier forms in Asia. So the bias have really been to think much more that it's in this late replacement, say 30, 40,000 years ago, that this happened. But what we find is that it seems to have happened in the Middle East. And perhaps in hindsight, it makes sense that when modern humans are very few and come out for the first time and meet Neanderthals, that's when Neanderthals have a chance to have a big impact on the human population.
Thanks very much.
Operator, we have time for a few more questions.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Peter Moon with Epoca Magazine, Brazil.
Hello. Hello, everybody. I'd like to catch the last question. When I received the embargoed release from Science, I just at that moment I just thought, aha, well, if there was interbreeding, maybe we could pinpoint that, for example, Rh negative factor could have been inherited from Neanderthals, as well as red hair, since we know that Neanderthals had red hair. Am I too far from the truth, or is it a possibility?
I mean, I think it's a possibility that some things that may affect how we look, for example, could have come from Neanderthals now when we now see this gene flow, but we don't know what yet. With respect to red hair, there is this previous paper, not from our group, but from our institute, that found one variant in one gene that may cause red hair. But that is actually a different variant than what causes redheads in Europe today. And the Neanderthals we have looked at here does not have that variant that was seen in that paper. So at least that was not something that was in all Neanderthals, and it's not the variant we see in Europe that was described there. So I think the it's totally unknown what, if anything, in, say, how we look would have come from Neanderthals in non-Africans.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, operator. We'll take another question, please.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Lisa Krieger with San Jose Mercury News.
Yes, thank you very much for your time. I wondered if you could characterize the source of the fossil, the bones that you used of Neanderthal. And also, just for the layperson, is it possible to describe the degree of commonality between Neanderthal and modern humans? You know, what percent do we share?
Yes. So these bones, they come from this cave site in Croatia, and they are little fragments or sort of fragments of 5 to 10 centimeters in size from long bones, from, say, the shin bones. And they seem to have been deliberately crushed, actually. Probably because one was, for some reason, consuming these individuals. It has been suggested by Tim White that this is evidence for cannibalism at this site and at other such sites. And two of these bones, we were able to date directly the bones by carbon dating. So one of them is 38,000 years old and the other one 44,000 years old. And they were excavated in the late 70s and in early 80s at this site in former Yugoslavia. Your second question was how we could characterize this 1 to 4% or put it in perspective or something like that?
Yeah, I'm sorry, maybe that wasn't clear, but you know, the average layperson reader wants to know how much do we have in common with them? You know, they're always interested in what percent mm-hmm. of commonality is there between mice and humans and chimps and humans.
I see in terms of sequence similarity. This is somehow, since Neanderthals fall into our variation for most of the genome, it's really so that I may, for any part of the genome we look at, be closer to the Neanderthal than what you are. But I think the interesting percentage that came out from this study is in a way that 1 to 4% of my DNA that I carry in myself, if I come from outside Africa, is from the Neanderthals. So if you like, the Neanderthals are not totally extinct. In some of us, they live on a little bit. And that is this 1 to 4% of my DNA that would come from Neanderthals.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we have time for two more questions.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Alan Boyle with MSNBC.
Hi, thank you. I wanted to ask about some of the regions that were under positive selection. There was reference to how some of these regions might be related to schizophrenia, Down syndrome, autism. What can you say about that connection? I'd love to hear what the potential implications of that are.
Well, I think that the only thing I would say about it is that this then suggests that some of the genes that were positively selected in early modern humans may have had to do with cognitive development of some sort. Now, this link to schizophrenia and autism and Down's cognitive impairments is, of course, only that when a gene is mutated in humans today, and that mutation has nothing to do with what is in the Neanderthals, then this has a tendency to lead to these problems. So this link to this disease only shows that these genes have something to do with cognitive development. It doesn't suggest that the Neanderthals had no autism or that they were more similar to people with autism or something like that. It just suggests there is a connection to cognitive development here. Does that answer your question at all?
Yes, I think so. So really, there's no implication, as you were saying, that there was an incidence of this sort of mutation in modern humans that was not found in Neanderthals. It suggests that there's a functionality involved in that. But is there a way to follow up on that? Is there any possibility to see whether there were particular cognitive functions that modern humans may have developed that made the difference?
Yes, so what we certainly want to do is to use this technology that we present in this accompanying paper
of pulling out particular regions from the Neanderthal genome from this complex mixture with the bacterial DNA and sequence to much higher accuracy and coverage those regions that were positively selected. So then we will be able to, in these regions, find all differences between the Neanderthal and modern humans. And the hope is, of course, that among those, one would be able to pinpoint by laboratory experiments in the end those things that have changed and might have been crucial here. And there is, of course, a whole school of thinking, for example, that suggests that autism affects some feature in our cognition that is very typical of modern humans, this sociality and our tendency to influence each other and so on, this map of mind that we can put ourselves in other people's situation. And it would be extremely interesting, of course, if one could find in the future a real connection there.
Thank you.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Carolyn Johnson with Boston Globe.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. I just wanted to ask if this gives evidence that interbreeding between Neanderthals and modern humans did occur, at least at some point. Like, why would it not have continued in Europe? Like, is there any explanation, since it seems like your data suggests that it did not continue? I mean, would that be a social barrier, or is there any reason, since we know it's possible, that it wouldn't have continued?
Well, I would just say, David should fill in, that I think I would second what David said earlier. It may be that it continued, but we don't detect it because the circumstances under which it happened. If it was, for example, already a very big human population that came to Europe that interbred with Neanderthals, we would have very little power to detect it today. Is that, David?
Yes, that's right. I think absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, and it may just be that we don't have power to detect gene flow that really did occur in Europe and elsewhere. That the all we can say is that what we are seeing right now is consistent with just a single episode of gene flow in the ancestral population of Europeans and Asians prior to the time that they diverged. We don't find any evidence for gene flow elsewhere or in another direction right now, but it could very well exist. We just don't have power to detect it.
So just to fill in, I think the breakthrough here really is to show that it could happen, right, at all, and it did happen. So biologically it was possible, and therefore we are much open to that, more open that it could have happened at other times when we don't detect it, because we now know it could happen.
Okay, great, thanks.
Thank you. Okay, operator, we'll take one final question.
Thank you. Your final question comes from Anna Gershenfeld with Publico Newspaper.
Yes, hi. Just one thing and then another question about what you just said, that it could happen, but it could happen or it did happen. It's a difference.
Yes, it's certainly a difference, but as David said, not finding evidence or something in the data doesn't mean that we know it did not happen.
Yes, of course, but concerning the Eurasian population before, you proved that it did happen. Your signal means that it did happen earlier.
Yes.
In one instance, that is clear that it did. You're not saying it could have; it did.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. The other thing is just about today, people are doing genetic sequencing and SNPs and all that in different companies. Will we be able to know if our DNA, our SNPs, are Neanderthal or not?
So, yes, I'm sure that some of these companies will in the future start to offer that. Maybe Ed has something more to say about that. I don't know.
I think it's likely to happen. That's all I would say at this point.
Because it's something people discuss online in the forums on those sites. I mean, they want to know, and they were talking about the microcephalin mutation and everything. And so maybe now they would have more evidence, more hard evidence to go on, do you think?
Yes.
I think there are some sections of the genome where if you look at modern variation in, say, the human genome reference sequence, we're not sure, but we're pretty confident that these segments are likely to be of Neanderthal gene flow origin. For example, out of these 10 out of 12 regions, most of those variants are likely to be of Neanderthal origin, although, mm-hmm. you know, the 2 out of 12 indicate that it's not 100%. So I think that this is not true for all the segments of Neanderthal origin. Yeah. We know that there's a sort of statistical aggregate signal that we're detecting, and most of it is not going to be these extreme cases that are easy to detect. Yeah. But there are segments that are we're likely to be able to say these are probably of Neanderthal origin.
Okay.
In non-Africans.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. On behalf of Science and its publisher, AAAS, I want to thank the panelists for participating today and the reporters who are communicating science broadly and upholding the science embargo set for tomorrow, Thursday, the 6th of May, 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. The papers will appear in the journal this Friday, the 7th of May. Audio files of this briefing will be posted on the SciPac website this afternoon. Please note that all the Neanderthal content, including both papers, the special online feature, which includes video, will be freely available without registration at the following URL, www.sciencemag.org/special/Neanderthal/starting-Thursday-evening, the 6th of May. This information is also included in the SciPac. If you have any further questions, please contact me or the Science Press team at 202-326-6440. Thank you.